I then talked to Ayla about what Tori had said the previous night and what he had said this morning. We both agreed on every detail of what had occurred the night before. We were both especially sure that Uri had handed me a gun. I then drove over to Shippy's home and asked him if he had Uri's Rossi revolver. He said, "Yes, I've had it here for the past 2 months." I checked to see if Uri had borrowed it recently. The answer was no. Shippy then showed me the revolver. It was the same one I had handled the previous night. Ayla and I went to see Uri at 8 p.m. He was running a fever of 38.2/B0C and had the flu. In spite of the illness, he was in a good mood. None of us talked about the night of the gun. We chatted about many things for the next 2 hours. Then Uri asked Ayla for a coin, and she gave him a 5 Agaroth coin. He placed this in a wooden matchbox and asked Ayla to place her hands over it. Ayla felt a tingle in her hands. The box was opened. The coin had vanished. It was 10:30 p.m. The phone rang, and Uri picked it up. He said to me very excitedly, "It's her, she's calling from the Sinai." I said, "Who? Who is calling?" He said, "Yaffa. Talk to her," and thrust the phone into my hand. Not knowing to whom I was talking, I said, "My name is Andrea, who are you?" A woman's voice said in broken English, "Pleased to meet you. I'm Yaffa. I do not speak English, only Hebrew." Just then Sarah Bursak walked into the room, and Uri said to her, "It's Yaffa on the phone from the Sinai. Talk to her." So I handed Sarah the phone. She talked with great excitement and enthusiasm in Hebrew to the woman for about 2 minutes and then handed the phone to Uri, who talked on for several more minutes in Hebrew. No one discussed the phone call when it ended. It all seemed so natural. Ayla and I left shortly thereafter. We drove to the Sharon Hotel discussing this phone call, speculating that Yaffa must be the secret love. The next morning Uri made a casual phone call to me to say that he was feeling better. Equally casually, I asked him about the phone call from the Sinai last night and who was Yaffa. He stated flatly, "There was no phone call last night." I insisted that there was a phone call and repeated to him in detail what Ayla and I had both witnessed. Uri sounded very distressed with me. "Andrea, there was no phone call. You must be getting sick. Please call Sarah, she'll tell you the same thing." I called Sarah and repeated my story about the phone call. She, too, denied it, saying, "Dr. Pugh Harridge, I like you very much, but I think you are very strange. This is not a good joke." I called Uri back to report on Sarah's denial and Ayla's affirmation of my story. He stated flatly, "Andrea, you dreamed the whole thing, and Ayla is just going along with you. Forget the whole story." However, Uri called me back in an hour and said, "I don't believe there was a phone call, but how did you find out that my secret love's name is Yaffa?" These 2 days' events numbed me. Sarah and Uri experienced one sequence, and Ayla and I experienced another, in the same time frame. I had discovered the truth about Uri's deepest secret, had had a gun in my hand that felt real, and had had a phone call experience that is real in my mind to this day. But most of all, I realized that the four of us had had an experience imprinted on our minds by what could only be the agency of Iz. I finally learned that, given the existence of Iz, I could never again know which of my experiences were directly imposed upon me by Iz and which were not. I have never been so deeply shaken in my life as when I realized the full implication of this power of Iz. I thought back to December 7th when Uri had walked toward a flashing blue light in an open field and had come back with my brass pen cartridge. All this could have been an illusion, similar to the one of the past 2 days. Although I still have the brass pen cartridge, I know that it could have appeared in Uri's hand, without lending any credence to the possible presence of a spacecraft. All I can vouch for is my experience, which I'd already come to realize could have been artificially imprinted by Iz. On New Year's Day 1972, I wanted to take a break from the heaviness of my education at the hands of Iz. I invited Ayla to take a ride into the countryside. We had absolutely no idea where we would go when we started. We were to decide our itinerary at any moment by the toss of a coin. We drove north toward Haifa in the dazzling bright winter sunshine. As we reached the area of the Carmel Hills near Mogan Michael, an unbelievably multicolored movement of clouds came in from the sea. I stopped driving to set up my Hasselblad camera to take purely artistic pictures of the cloud forms and colors against this incredible sky blue background. There were many tornado funnels in the clouds, patches of dark thunderous clouds. I have never before seen such a display of cloud beauty in the sky. We drove on north past Haifa into a heavy thunderstorm. In the darkness and driving rain I got lost, but I kept on driving, since it didn't make any difference where we were going. When the air cleared somewhat, I found myself on the road to Safat, one of my favorite places in all of Israel. After Safat, we went down to the Sea of Galilee and to Tiberias. Finally at 10 p.m. we decided to return to Tel Aviv, via the town of Afula, in the Jezreel Valley. As we climbed out of the basin of the Sea of Galilee over the mountains, we both saw a red disk in the sky, similar to the one I had seen in the Sinai. When we reached the top of the mountain where the sky was clear and the view unimpeded, it disappeared over Mount Tabor. As we descended into the valley of Jezreel, we entered heavy low-lying fog banks. Just as we left Afula, a white hawk cut through the fog and passed just inches in front of my windshield. This was a startling vision to both Ayla and myself. As we were discussing this sighting, we encountered another heavy fog bank. The visibility could not have been more than 10 meters, and I had to slow down to some 30 kilometers per hour. Then directly ahead of the car there flashed a red comet-like light. It had a trajectory like that of a baseball descending from the air toward the ground. What was even stranger was that it appeared to be 100 meters ahead of the car, beyond the range of headlight visibility. There was something unworldly about this light as it plunged toward the ground into the road ahead, and then went out. As I approached the area of its fall, there was nothing to be seen. Suddenly I heard a cricket sound. A road intersection appeared going to the right, and without a thought I swung the car north onto this road to listen for the cricket sound. As I listened, and as Ayla listened, for she had heard it too, a white hawk suddenly flashed through the headlight glow. I wrote later that night in my notes that the above pattern of events, red light, hawk, is highly subjective and probably has no particular significance. But I found out later that I was wrong, that very significant events were going on. In the following weeks I was approached by my friends Reuven and Jacob, who tried to hint to me very gently that there was increasing concern by the Israeli Army High Command about my presence in Israel. I was also interviewed at times by intelligence officers and knew that trouble for me was brewing. I also found out by other means that all my mail was being read, my phone was tapped, and that I was under 24-hour-a-day personal surveillance. Later, I also found out that on this New Year's Day, as I was being followed, the best operatives in the country would suddenly lose me. They would radio for help, and another team in a car would locate my car and then they would lose me. The report that I had totally disappeared at Afula, I found out, started a major investigation about me. Of course, I was unaware of all this at the time it was happening. The Israeli intelligence people were getting the same lessons in mind control bias that I was getting. The only difference is that I knew the lessons were from an extraterrestrial intelligence. The major display of lights in the sky started in quite an innocuous way on January 2, 1972. I was standing on the balcony of room 1101 at the Sharon Hotel at 7:30 p.m., enjoying the view of Tel Aviv stretching away toward Jaffa. Then due south, beyond Jaffa, appeared a flashing red star, pulsing at about one pulse per second. It was stationary. The flashes continued for about 30 pulses, then it was gone. I called to Ayla to witness it, and she saw the last few bursts of light. The next thing I saw I took to be some kind of meteorological experiment. A huge orange flare burst in the air where the red light had been. As the flare plummeted toward Earth, a twisted trail of smoke hung in the air. As the orange flare came to within 1,000 feet or so of Earth, a second flare burst a certain distance from where the first had burst, and followed the same pattern. This went on until there were 7 pillars of smoke in the sky. I assumed that these flares had been released to measure wind patterns. Ayla and I discussed this phenomenon as such. Later that day we went to see Yuri perform at a show at the Tzavda in Tel Aviv. I told him about the 7 pillars of smoke generated by orange flares. He looked at me as though I were crazy and said, "They don't send up smoke patterns in Israel to study the wind. But let's check it out." He phoned the weather service, the army, and the air force. No one had sent up any flares south of Tel Aviv at 7:30 p.m. Suri convinced me that it was not a meteorological effect. But what was it? It did not occur to either of us that it could be connected to Is, because of the smoke. But this phenomenon was clarified the next day on a night drive. See Appendix 4. On January 3, while sitting on the balcony of my room at the Sharon, Ayla, Iris, and I saw in the clear daylight the same kind of hawks that we had seen 2 days ago to the west of Afula. I studied the birds carefully as 2 of them floated past my balcony at eye level. They were definitely of the hawk family, with a 2-foot wingspread in soaring flight. The entire underside of the bird was white with darker stippling. The top side of the bird was a uniform dark dove gray. At times one of the birds would glide in from the sea right up to within a few meters of the balcony. It would flutter there in one spot and stare at me directly in the eyes. It was a unique experience to look into the piercing, intelligent eyes of a hawk. It was then that I knew I was not looking into the eyes of an earthly hawk. This was confirmed about 2 p.m. when Uri's eyes followed a feather, loosened from the hawk, that floated on an updraft toward the top of the Sharon Tower. As his eye followed the feather to the sky, he was startled to see a dark spacecraft parked directly over the hotel. We all looked where he pointed, but we did not see what he saw. But I believed that he saw what he said he saw. I was of the opinion that the birds were peregrine falcons. But I knew that this species was probably recently extinct in the United States. I did not know if this species were known in Israel. Yuri stoutly upheld the view that there were no hawks at all in Israel, only kites. He told us that the hawks were sent by Is to guard and protect me. He felt that this was simply a form taken by Is, just as they took the form of a spacecraft, because it suited their purposes. I dub this hawk Horus and still use this name each time he appears to me. Yuri was scheduled to go to the Sinai to entertain the troops on January 9 and wanted both Ayala and me to go along. Since there were female entertainers as part of the troop, he felt he could get permission for Ayala to go. This time he got written clearance for us beforehand. We met at Lod Airport at 6:30 a.m. and arrived at an airbase in the Sinai by 9:20 a.m. upon landing. There was a big scene with a security officer about allowing Ayla and me to go to the Suez Canal with Uri and the troop. However, Uri in his inimitable way shouted down the objections of the security officer. We were allowed to go to the canal zone. Between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., we rode in the back of a truck with a group of entertainers. For me it was a profound experience to go through the long canyons of the Mitla Pass littered with the wreckage of the Six-Day War. When we reached the Suez Canal at 1 p.m., the entertainers split into groups, each going his way. Yuri, Ayla, and I were escorted by an officer to the top of an observation tower where soldiers peered across the canal by day and by night. There was a dreamlike quality to this scene. The sun shone brightly and sparkled off the blue waters of the canal. The seagulls swooped and foraged for their food. On this side of the canal the Israeli soldiers walked on top of their fortifications. As we stood on the tower, in full view, one of the Egyptian soldiers shouted obscenities at us in Arabic, an Israeli soldier shouted back a choice obscenity in Hebrew. Then the quiet, the sound of gulls, and the warmth of the sun. Was this the boundary across which, a few weeks ago, steel and fire were to hurtle the world into a global holocaust? We were served a hot lunch by a proud and sweating sergeant major. At 2 p.m. a group of 36 soldiers came from the depths of the bunkers of the Barlav line to see Yuri do a show in a sandbagged open area, safe from line-of-sight fire. Another entertainer, Avi, sang a lusty song with his guitar. The soldiers, with Ust-C machine guns on their backs, cheered wildly. Then Uri came on, calling upon a soldier and asking him to concentrate on his sweetheart's name. Uri thought for 10 seconds and gave the name correctly as Bruria. More cheers. Uri then had each soldier step up and think of a color, number, letter, name of a car, a capital city, etc. For every one of the soldiers, Uri gave the correct telepathic answer. By now the wild cheering had subsided. There was instead a hushed awe. Uri then repaired a broken watch by passing his hand over it. Then he asked a soldier to hold a key in his hand. Uri placed his hand over the soldier's for 10 seconds. When the soldier opened his hand, the key was bent at a 90-degree angle. At the end of the performance, the soldiers followed Uri silently to the truck as we boarded to leave. We went on to the next bunker, and Uri repeated the same kind of show. At 4 p.m. we headed back into the heart of the Sinai via the Mitla Pass. As the sun went down, the wind, the cold, and the jolting of the truck lowered our spirits to a state of numbed withdrawal. It was dark by 7 p.m. as we rolled into some unknown army base. We were fed dinner by torchlight. The word was whispered around that there was an air alert on. Some intelligence reports said that Arab planes would enter the area. There was to have been a show that night. But since no lights were allowed on the base, it was dubious that it would be presented. We were huddled into a small office until 9 p.m., surrounded by soldiers who mobbed and pressed upon Uri. Ayla and I were practically crushed by this herd activity. I was prepared to see them start tearing at Uri's clothes in sheer admiration. A young girl soldier offered a gold chain to Uri. He held his hand over it, and it broke in two. Uri was then pressed into doing a telepathy test over the telephone with a general from another base. The test was so successful that the general told Uri that he was going to drive over to see him personally. It was then that I discovered the function of the base we were on. It was an elaborate decoy base designed to draw enemy bombers toward it, and away from more vital targets, a discovery that did not make me any too happy. At 10 p.m. the general and his staff entered the packed office. He made an offer to Uri to do a show at his base at midnight. Uri inquired if that meant a warm bed for the night, and the general replied that it did, for all of us. So we roared off in 2 command cars into the night. I was surprised to find that we were on a tortuous winding road going up to a mountain eyrie. At the top there was a forest of radar towers and antennae. It was obvious to me that we were in a most unusual electronic warfare center. There was another hassle about the security status of Ayla and me, but we were finally allowed on the base. Uri did a very impressive show. What interested me was that this was the first time I had ever seen him perform for a purely scientific and intellectual group. Everyone that I could see in the audience appeared to be of PhD caliber. Yet they were just as enthusiastic and excited as the 19-year-old soldiers on the canal. The commanding general was obviously very impressed with Uri and held a secret conference with him. Uri did not tell me what advice he gave to the general. We did get quarters that night with electric heaters and plenty of blankets. My bones really ached from all the jolting truck rides of the long day. At 5:30 a.m. we were aroused and piled into a command car. Now I could see that we were in a high mountain area that had a clear view of the Sinai in all directions. As the sun arose, the desert became a pastel wonderland, a sight of immense beauty. I also found that we were traveling east. As we neared the region where Uri and I had seen the red eye of Is in the sky a month ago, there appeared to our left at low altitude a giant spaceship. Now Uri, Ayla, and I clearly saw it. It appeared to be not more than 2 miles away, but desert air is deceptive when it comes to judging distances. The spaceship hugged the top of the ridge to our left and floated with the stability of a dirigible. I noticed that it did not cast a shadow on the hill. I judged it to be double the length of a Boeing 747. In fact, it had a shape as though two B-747s, without wings, were stuck together tail to tail but with one of the planes upside down. The ship did not glint in the sun, there was no reflective surface on it, there were no windows or portals. It had a very smooth, dull, metallic gray surface. Uri, Ayla, and I were in the back seat of the command car. The driver and two other military personnel sat in the front. Without giving these three a clue as to what they might see, Yuri pointed directly to the ridge of the hill below the spaceship and asked them in Hebrew, "What is that?" All three stared directly at the spaceship and said in substance, "There is only the hill and the blue sky. What do you see?" Yuri would not reveal what he saw, but prodded them to concentrate on the spot in the sky where the spaceship floated. Not one of the three saw the ship. Finally, they asked Yuri, "What's so important about that spot?" Yuri said in a joking way, "I thought maybe there was a UFO there." They accepted his words as a joke and stopped looking. Yuri, Ayla, and I just watched in total fascination. We soon realized that the spaceship was moving with us at the same speed as our car. This went on for a half hour, and then as we reached a turn where the road went north, the spaceship continued east, dropping out of sight behind a hill. I recognize the possibility that there may not have been a spaceship there at all. I am aware that the three men in the command car saw nothing because there was nothing to see. I recognize that the three of us certainly had the image of a spaceship in our minds. But I believe that that image was placed there by some superior intelligence which may or may not have required the prop of an actual spaceship. The picture of that spaceship floating in its metallic splendor over the Sinai Desert is still firmly imprinted in my mind. We arrived at the airbase at which we had landed the day before at 7:30 a.m., January 10. I must confess that each of us felt frozen, dirty, tired, and aching. I was back at the Sharon Hotel by 10 a.m. I immediately took a hot bath, shaved, and made extensive notes on what had happened in the desert. I spent the day on my balcony in the sun going over date to have mutual interest with Ayla before she left on the morrow. There was no question in my mind as I observed her that the experiences of the past week had destroyed all of her previous conceptions of parapsychology. She was also personally shaken up. What she had witnessed was more than she could bear. She frankly admitted that she could not keep up this kind of pace in acquiring new, unmanageable information. I drove Ayla to Lod Airport the next morning. When I returned to the hotel, there was a phone message from Ori. I called him up, and he began to thank me profusely for the most wonderful present he had ever received, the belt massager. Now, there is a background to this story that I must tell first. About a week earlier, Rory began to complain to Ayla and me about his figure, that he was getting fat. We just laughed at him and his vanity. He is 6 feet 2 inches tall and weighed 172 pounds. He was not at all overweight. He exercised at least 2 hours every day. But he persisted in his belief that he had fat bumps on him that should be melted down. He had the idea that a belt massager would do it. Ayla was very good with Uri. She explained to me that her husband had the same narcissism as did Uri and she knew how to handle the problem. She asked Uri to assemble all the specifications for the kind of massager he wanted and then to report to us. This kept him busy for a day. When he found out the kind of massager he wanted and got the price, he came to me crestfallen, saying that the cost was prohibitive. Could I find out what the price would be in the United States? I knew he had outwitted me, but I went along with the game. I called up my friend Solveig Clark in New York and asked her to send me catalogs on these machines and the prices, including air freight and duty. In 3 days I had this information in hand. I went over the catalogs with Uri. He picked a certain machine manufactured by Metz in the United States of a blue color. When I told what it would cost him, he was staggered by the price. Finally he said, "Forget the whole business. I don't really need the machine." Now he was telling me on the phone, "I just walked into my apartment with Sarah Bursack. There, plugged into the wall, was a blue Metz belt massager, the same model I had picked out of the catalog. Since you were the only one who knew what I wanted, I knew that it came from you. Nobody has ever done anything for me like this in my life." "Yuri," I said, "I didn't give you that present. It must be someone else. I can't believe it, Andrea. Then maybe your friend in New York didn't understand you, maybe she ordered it. Is there a crate there? Is there an invoice or a packing slip? How did it get in the apartment anyway? You know that it takes days to get things through customs. My God, you're right. My mother is away, nobody was in the apartment. How did they get in to deliver it? He said. Why don't you check it out on your end, and I'll call New York and see what was done there, I suggested. Yuri came to see me at 4 p.m. just as I was getting a call through to New York to Solveig. Solveig stated that she had not ordered or shipped a Metspelt massager. She also said that she would like to come soon to visit me in Israel, which I thought was a splendid idea. Yuri and I looked at each other, we finally knew who had delivered the belt massager. I said to Yuri, they must really love you to humor you on this level of personal vanity. Besides, someone up there is a real joker, this is cosmic humor. A belt massager for the man who is in perfect physical shape. What will they do next? The massager was real, had a serial number, was made in Brooklyn, and worked with bone jolting efficiency. The carton in which it had come had no markings on it, and there was no invoice. It looked as if it had come from a warehouse. I returned to my hotel, had an early dinner, and prepared to go to bed early. I recalled with sweeping sadness that 1 year ago that day I had received the news of Arago's death. And on that day I had resolved to change my way of life by seeking the good, the true, the beautiful. I gauged the progression I had made in the year's interim. It was more transformation than progression, and I felt that it was just beginning. When I awoke on the morning of January 12th, I glanced at the Geneva watch on my wrist. It had stopped at, or been moved to, 9:45 and 45 seconds, 21:45 and 45 seconds, while I was asleep. The electric clock showed that it was 8:56 a.m. The last time this had happened was on December 26, 1971. For a moment I had the panicky thought that something had gone wrong, that the war threat was on again. I walked into the bathroom, turned on the radio, and got ready to bathe. Right after the 9 a.m. station break, the regular Voice of America program was blanked out. A husky voice came out of the radio saying, "Andrea, be prepared, in a few days." It faded off in a garbled way. I knew that it was an overlay voice by Iz. But what bothered me was the imperfect quality of the voice transmission. I had become used to perfection in the execution of Iz phenomena. I telephoned Uri and recited what had happened, but he had no idea as to what it all meant. The next day, January 13th, seemed ominously quiet. I was driving from Tel Aviv to the Sharon along the coast road that goes by Dop Airport when Horace appeared opposite my car, standing still in the air heading into the wind. It was 2:30 p.m. I stopped the car to watch this magnificent hawk. Then, literally from nowhere appeared another hawk, which flew alongside of Horace. They wheeled off slowly to the right, landing about 30 feet from my car, and mated there in the field. I went on to the hotel and spent a very quiet evening there, watching and waiting. The next day was Friday, January 14th. My watch ran normally, there was no hawk to be seen. The skies darkened and the wind whipped up to gale force from the sea. The rain came down in sheets before the wind. Alone in his apartment in Tel Aviv, Yuri saw a huge silent spacecraft glide over northern Tel Aviv. Then he saw the lights of the city flicker and go out. All of Israel was plunged into wet darkness. At this moment, 7:30 p.m., I was sitting in my hotel room at Herzliya, looking toward Tel Aviv. Suddenly I saw only blackness where there had been myriads of city lights. Now I knew the meaning of all the warning signs of the past 3 days. On February 1st, Turi and I were standing at 12 noon on the seaward side of the swimming pool of the Hilton Hotel. The pool was crowded with swimmers. As we looked south toward Jaffa over the sea, we saw a gigantic display in the sky. First, a bright flare fell from a height of about 4,000 feet, some 10 miles away. As the flare fell, a pillar of white smoke remained in the air to mark the full trail. As the first flare hit the horizon, the next flare was released some 500 meters to the right of the first. It took 2 minutes and 20 seconds for each flare to fire and descend to the horizon level. In this manner, 7 flares were released, leaving 7 pillars of white smoke in the sky, which lasted for some 30 minutes. Yuri and I looked around us. It was quite clear that nobody else saw what we were seeing. A newspaper and radio check showed that no one had released 7 flares that day behind Jaffa. That evening, Uri and I were successful in getting answers to our questions from the tape recorder.